Good morning and good afternoon, everyone. This is Diane from Praxis, and welcome to the Advocacy Learning Center's bi-monthly affinity discussion. I'll be moderating today's call, and we have with us participants from two different classes, Class H and I. So thank you all for joining us. In addition to me, we have Sandy with us from Praxis and Priya from Monavi. And we're also happy to welcome two ALC faculty who will be participating in our conversation today. Abby Tassel and Laura Williams will be sharing their experience and their knowledge and join us as we kind of wrestle and think about the questions we raise in today's discussion. Abby, as some of you know, because you would have been, I believe, Abby, at the Class H Institute, I'm thinking. Anyway, it's hard to keep up. But Abby has been involved in work to end violence against women for over 15 years, both in crisis centers and on a college campus. She has experience with direct service, with program development, and with the application of research that guides work to end sexual and physical violence. Abby is currently the Assistant Director of WISE, an organization working with survivors of domestic and sexual violence in New Hampshire. Laura Williams is the Team Leader and National Technical Assistance Project Director for the Sexual Violence Justice Institute at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. She provides analysis, training, and technical assistance on multidisciplinary collaborative responses to sexual violence. Laura has 20 years of experience working to improve sexual response to sexual assault survivors, as well as serving as an advocate and a trainer for volunteers and professionals. We're so happy to have both of them with us today. This is our second affinity discussion call in a three-part series in which we're focusing on social change advocacy and sexual assault. In our first call, we explored some general questions around advocacy for sexual assault survivors, including just looking at what are the challenges that we're facing as advocates, what challenges are our programs facing. We had Sandra Pilgrim Lewis from Shelter Inc., who's also ALC faculty on with us, and she talked specifically about dual programs and what some dual programs are facing. And we also talked about, and like Abby, formerly a campus advocate, and I talked some about addressing sexual assault on campus and the ways that programs are and can collaborate with campuses to provide sexual assault advocacy and more broadly address sexual assault. And now here in our next two calls, we're going to be exploring the concept of justice, which is, of course, a very broad topic and a complex topic for sexual assault survivors, whether they're choosing to report an assault or whether they get drawn into systems. And we're going to be talking in these two calls about what justice means, where systems may be working and where they may be falling short, and how advocates are working to change how institutions and communities respond to sexual assault. In our call today, our conversation, we'll be looking at what survivors identify as their needs related to justice and talking about how the criminal legal system in particular and also civil options may or may not meet those needs. And also think about what are the implications for our daily advocacy and our work with women and our work with survivors. So these ALC affinity discussions are really intended to create a space for us to continue our exploration together. They're designed to provide a forum, create dialogue. They aren't meant as a training session, but really as conversations. And that includes between our guests and our faculty, but you as well. You are welcome to sit back and listen, of course, but what we hope is that you will also feel comfortable joining the conversation or piping in with any questions or comments that you might have. Although at the same time, we know that participating by phone can have its own challenges. So I want to invite Liz to join us and kind of guide us through how people can join our conversation today. Liz?
And hello, classes H and I. So just to remind you about this affinity discussion telephone call, so on one level, this conversation will occur between the ALC staff and faculty and our two guest speakers today. But, of course, the conversation is so enriched by your participation. And so while your phone lines are going to be muted, you can at any point jump into the conversation by pressing star 1 on your telephone, getting into the operator queue, waiting a few moments, and then sharing your thoughts with the whole group, or by sending an email to liz@praxisinternational.org. And with just a little bit of patience for the technology, we will do our best to integrate you into a broader conversation amongst our participants today. And so please utilize that technology and share your thoughts for everyone's benefit. I also just want to remind you that this session is being recorded and will be available on the ALC Protected Class page. So if you want to revisit it or share it with your colleagues who are not able to participate today, it will be posted as of next week, and that's an option to you. So those are my suggestions, Diane. Back to you.
Great. Thank you so much, Liz. And I'll just reiterate that so please feel free to jump into the conversation either by pressing star 1 or by emailing liz@praxisinternational.org with questions or comments. So I'm so happy to welcome Abby and Laura to our conversation, and I'm going to start them out with a super easy question today, which is not really a simple question at all. It could, in fact, probably take up our entire conversation or our entire series of calls. But what I'm thinking about as we talk about justice for sexual assault survivors is what we mean by justice. How do we define it? How is it defined in our culture, and what are those implications for sexual assault survivors? So, Laura, I'm going to start out with you. What are your thoughts as we think about the meaning of justice?
Yeah, that's a small question, right? So, thanks. But in the spirit of the call, and in our preparation, what I may do rather than try and take it head on is just explore some of the ways, particularly in our field, that I think are some ways of thinking and talking about this that might expand the rest of the conversation. So let's take first, for example, often the way we measure and think about really outside of advocacy, but sometimes in advocacy too, is that sense of convictions in the criminal legal system. And yet, it wouldn't take that long to talk and recognize that probably feels insufficient to most of us, that there are times, and I certainly remember cases where survivors I worked with, the way they were responded to throughout the process, feeling like they were listened to and believed, that people took seriously their needs, were helpful and healing in their own right, and that sometimes even when the case wasn't charged, they still walked away with a feeling that somebody in authority listened to them and validated what happened, and that given certain constraints, they recognize. So there's still an element of justice in that. And other times, conversely, where I can remember, working with survivors when a case went all the way through prosecution and maybe even ended in conviction, but they felt so alienated from the very process that started in such a personal and dramatic way that it, felt like it really wasn't something that equated to their sense of justice. So that just muddies it a little bit. I mean, we move off, and if it's not just convictions, what else, might there be going on there? And I would just add a couple of things, and then Abby or others might want to range in. So if it's not just that, do we go on the other side and say, well, it's about, how a survivor, what she wants for herself, his or herself, is it self-defined? And that would be a really interesting, as Diane alluded, that we might be able to all talk about that for the next couple hours. But, it would be worth thinking about what are the strengths of that way of defining and thinking about justice and what maybe some of the limitations are. And some of the ways we think about maybe some of the limitations are that issue of, you know, for some survivors, the criminal legal system isn't a part of maybe what justice making might look like. And so where does that place us, though, with the idea that that there are real public safety or community norms that have been violated in the act of sexual assault or in the act of the crime itself that need to be attended to? So I have some additional thoughts, but this might be a good time. I guess the only other thing I would say is in the work I do, I think another distinction that can be really useful is moving off of justice mostly as a noun and into something like justice making, and thinking of it as a verb and more as a process. And so to me, that opens up a whole range of other things that we might include. And I have a list, but we'll hold on for now and see if that's a place, been a place to start.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I appreciate your comments, Laura, and it does open up so many avenues, that paths that we could wind down during our conversation today. And I'm already anticipating that we will want to keep talking at the end of our 90 minutes. So, but it's such an interesting concept to think about justice making as a verb versus justice as this very nice, neat box noun. So I'm confident we'll get back to talking more about that. But let me pull Abby in. Abby, welcome.
Hi.
What are your thoughts as you hear Laura's comments or your own thoughts on this conversation around justice and what it means as we begin our conversation?
I guess the first thing that I really start to think about is how wonderful it is to have these opportunities to take a step back when we're in the advocacy world to be thinking about it instead of constantly kind of just plowing ahead. And I think in our individual advocacy, we are often caught up with defining justice as what the individual is looking for, which in a lot of ways there may be a lot of similarities to kind of the bigger picture definitions of justice in terms of, you know, being heard and acknowledged and believed and having choices and feeling safe, having privacy. You know, what can be done to protect others? And I think we in particular see this a lot when we start to have the conversations with survivors about what we might know about the research that exists and the cultural context maybe of the violence, and women start to think like, oh, you know, instead of being framed as, you know, oh my gosh, I thought I did something wrong, they start to be thinking more like, oh, this is a serial perpetrator, and I might have a role to play in being able to end his serial perpetration or decrease the likelihood that he can be perpetrating with impunity in the community. And also that, you know, from our ALC, we know that as advocates, we are doing this individual work, but also always thinking about the systems and the, you know, what we can be doing to make changes institutionally and in our communities and, you know, in our society. So, and as the individual work so often allows us to see what's happening in those other places and allows us to do some of that work. And one of the places that I think we've seen this a lot is the desire that people will have to, when interacting with the criminal legal system, really just getting an idea of what that system is doing or trying to do and having a sort of transparent analysis of it. So even if the law enforcement officer is being very discouraging or it's at the prosecutor's office and the prosecutor is, you know, thinking that they're not going to be able to take the case forward, to be able to sit down with that person and really hear why it is that they are thinking that way. And, you know, so, and maybe for that individual, I think for many individuals that feels more, there's more accountability there. And I do, accountability is a word that comes up a lot for me, I think, around justice. And also, allows us to hear more about what they're thinking so that then when we're thinking about institutional change, you know, what, where we can be looking at gaps. I think I'm done.
Yeah. What was that, Abby?
But I think I'm done for the moment.
And opened up, you know, 100 new paths that
I know.
Wander down. Yeah, I mean, I think this is such an interesting concept as we think about the ALC, kind of how we're constructed and intertwining individual and institutional and community advocacy. It seems like justice is such a rich topic for weaving in and out of those three aspects of the advocacy that we do. When you mentioned that individual and institutional, and both Lauren, you mentioned the aspect of what is the role of the community, and we will be looking more at that in our third call, our third and final call in this series. So looking more at kind of the concepts around community accountability and restorative justice, and some of those pieces. I think all of us on this call, so all the Class H and I participants, and the ALC faculty, and Praxis and Monavie staff, are all or have been advocates. And in that role, I think we have all heard from survivors, from women we've worked with, about what their needs are or what their expectations are around the broad concept of justice, which isn't always referred to as justice. So I think, you know, one of the things that's occurring to me is what are the ways that we, that hold justice as a noun, as Laura referred to it. So what are the ways that we have that on our menu of services of what we offer? Again, in ALC, when we talk about, okay, these are the things as programs, or do we tend to have a menu of services, and what does the menu of justice options look like when we are providing advocacy for survivors. Abby, and I know you're a longtime advocate, both on the community and on campus. Can you talk a little bit about some of the things over the years that you've heard from survivors that they've identified? And in part, I'm thinking just broadly about their needs, but then thinking about which of those needs relate to justice.
Yeah. So certainly this piece about being able to tell and be heard is a common theme, and, of course, being believed, which in, I think, our work as advocates, we so often see that we are really the pocket in communities that where people know they can and will be just believed. And then also this, you know, feeling safe. So how am I going to be protected? And, you know, whether you're in the community at large or on a college campus, what is going to be offered through whatever systems to, you know, allow this person to feel safer, whether it's, you know, getting the perpetrator out of the housing or out of the classes, a protective order in the community. And, of course, in the criminal legal system, are law enforcement officers, if it's been reported, are they arresting, or are they, you know, doing an investigation which they may feel would be beneficial to the investigation to not arrest, and even maybe to we sometimes will hear that they would prefer for the woman to not do even a protective order of, a civil order, because they feel like it will sort of tip off the perpetrator. And these needs that the person actually has, once again, I think often are very closely aligned with, many of the definitions of justice and, the Desmond Tutu one that I think we're all familiar with in terms, because of the ALC is, this telling the truth and then repairing the harm. And repairing the harm is so much of, I think what we're doing in our individual advocacy, for that person at least. And then, once again, when we start talking about like the bigger picture, often individuals are really interested in being a part of repairing a larger harm as well. And I think in our work, we often see women who come to our organization then want to volunteer on our crisis line because they see that as a way of repairing harm beyond their individual experience, and being active in our movement as being a way that they can start to also change the conditions and repair harm in a way that reflects kind of the realities of sexual violence in general, as opposed to, this individual hurt me.
Right.
And also, just one more thing, just occurred to me. I was thinking about work on college campuses, and for me, that I think it was one of the things that was so exciting about it. And we still, I'm in a college community, so we have many college students who volunteer in our crisis line, and that there's just so much to be done. And when we have young people coming into the organization and into the movement, and seeing all that there is to do within the movement and to change the conditions that gave rise to the violence in the first place, and are really starting off their careers and their lives and thinking, do I want to become an attorney? Do I want to go into some sort of government work? Like, they're, it just, for me, is very exciting to see that.
Yeah. So much of what we talked about in our last call was, I think, both the challenges and opportunities, but, so many opportunities in working in that campus environment. So, absolutely. I want to remind people that we invite you to join in this conversation. You can press *1 if you have a question or comment related to what we're talking about here. And you can also email liz@praxisinternational.org if you would prefer to email your question or comment. So please join us in our conversation. We'd love to hear from you. And I know Sandy and Priya, we have you on the line as well. Is there anything you'd like to jump in to add at this point? I pause a little because there's always that possibility that somebody's muted and they're talking, and then it takes them a little while to realize they're muted. Not that I've personally ever done that. Maybe yesterday I did. Possibly the day before as well. But all right. So I think so often unsurprising, but the fallback position in talking about justice becomes a conversation about the criminal legal system. And, it's what many people think of first or only, the only thing they think of when they think, and I'm thinking of our broader society here, not just survivors, what people think of when they think of justice options. But as we've explored a little bit, and I think as most advocates know, it's not a place that survivors often find justice. And I would say that if we're equating justice with a conviction, as Laura mentioned earlier. Laura, I know you've been kind of giving all this some thought, and it's part of the work you do as well, but what do you want us to be thinking and talking about regarding the criminal legal system and our its role in justice making.
Yeah, again, you gave me the, like, really tangible questions I can just, no, that's great.
Yeah,
so,
yes, no.
Yeah. Just think about this one thing. Now, what's really great about this, let me just lay out a few things we can talk about. So I think about both tangible supports, I mean, literal things. So people need very specific things, and we don't often think of those as part of justice if we're thinking about, even if we think about accountability, whether it's criminal legal system related or outside of the criminal legal system, we often equate justice also primarily with accountability, which isn't bad, but if we think about it as a verb, the ability for the victim to participate in some meaningful way in the process, to understand and make meaningful choices about things, all of those things, you know, also mean that there's a role for somebody, and hopefully all of us, to create the environment where that survivor can move out of crisis, you know, for one. And any of us in, that would face trauma, that's not the time that some of these more, you know, more abstract notions are in place. So there are some real tangibles, is my point. Everything from, you know, in sexual assault, they took my clothes at the hospital. Do I need, I need some clothes, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I'll never forget, like, it was so, a case I worked on in a hospital response where actually, we didn't often do this, and this is a topic for another time, but I actually picked up the survivor at her house to take her to the hospital, and again, we didn't often do that, but nonetheless, and I said to her, I live in Minnesota, I was doing my work in Minnesota, I said, do you want to grab a coat? And she said, oh, yeah, okay, my brain's just not working the way it normally does. And I thought, well, duh, you know, like, I'm an advocate, right? Of course, why would I expect, like, that was a conscious,
yeah,
you know, choice? And it seems so minor, but my point being that there are all sorts of tangible supports, and literally, you know, when we do things like, say, the public or the county or the state should pay for exams, I think that's part of justice making as well. We're saying as a community, you know, you're not having to bear the burden of all the costs and all the challenges related to this. It takes it to, there's a author that talks about when that moment when she heard that this exam was going to be paid for, it shifted for her this private nightmare into a sense that just this recognition, even in that one thing, that a larger group had decided this is not acceptable and we're going to be part of the solution. And that, you know, some of those tangible things have that symbolic, weight to them. They're not just, they can be about literally helping, you know, those needs, but I would just bring up that we, not necessarily overlooking that. And then, of course, the intangibles often, which are about, as Abby started talking about before, am I being believed? And am I being, you know, sort of treated as a suspect, or am I being believed and helped? And part of that is a really important element, I think, of justice making, which is this idea of being able to speak the truth about what happened. And, you know, that's quite frankly more than just being asked about the facts, and or being interviewed about the facts. This truth-telling has to do with the characteristics of, you know, what happened and how it affected me and what I saw. And I think, you know, the criminal legal system can and needs to do a better job even with that part, but that's quite frankly where the larger community system, and I think often the role of advocates and others often play a really key role too. So these intangibles about being believed, about being respected, being treated respectfully, information and being part of the group of people that can, you know, make decisions about cases. So we try and look at all the levels of that, and quite frankly, we could go on and list more, but you know, are they aligning? Are we giving, you know, survivors really mixed messages? Hey, we want you to come forward and get help, and you deserve that, and it wasn't your fault. But then the first, you know, interaction they have with any sort of traditional community system that would be a part of that actually, you know, holds them at length or starts with the question of when did this happen and why, it, you know, it lacks this understanding about the brain and trauma, and the survivor ends up feeling like they're not being believed, or that maybe they got it wrong and it was their own experience. So I think both the tangible and intangibles, I think some of the other levels of in the criminal legal system about helping responders themselves understand the power of them saying, I believe you and this shouldn't have happened to you is huge. That acknowledging of that violation that survivor experienced, you know, often is a proxy and stands in for sometimes the apology or the acknowledgement from the perpetrator, which you know, may never come, quite frankly. So there are other pieces we could go on. Certainly the other pieces around even tangible things like restitution that can, again, provide both a tangible help but also the symbolic role of saying, you know, we want to help and try and restore you. But I would not disagree that in practice there can often be this gap between our presumed hopes and values and how it actually plays out, and I think that's part of the work of institutional system advocacy. I would just say, in this role of community you mentioned earlier, I just wanted to say, you know, one of my favorite quotes is by a man by the name of Jim Corbett, and he said, individuals can resist injustice, but only in community can we do justice. So, again, that emphasis on doing justice as a verb, a bunch of actions, and then also that it really can't be the burden of the individual to figure it out alone. They can resist injustice, but I think inherently justice making, whether it's the criminal legal system or not, is a community enterprise. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that raises so many thoughts for me. I mean, I think back to just, you know, the recent advocacy I was doing, and that I'd say the most common things that I heard from over the many years of working with women, with survivors, was what they wanted was for him to know that he did something wrong and for him not to do it to anyone else.
And
I always struggled as an advocate with wanting to be realistic about what the system could or couldn't do, thinking, you know, prisons don't rehabilitate people generally into not doing it again. I mean, if this entire prison industrial complex can't keep him from perpetrating again. But some of what I'm hearing from what you're saying is that there are ways that the criminal legal system, depending on its careful and compassionate response, can a little bit play that role of affirming that survivor and maybe even leading to that offender, the doer of harm, knowing that he did something wrong. Maybe, but we also know that, you know, perpetrators go through are occasionally convicted and still feel that they didn't do anything wrong.
Right, and, you know, I'll just say this real quickly I know at least I've been fairly abstract. I mean, there are some very specific, tangible ways, right? And so the fact that even some of the basic crime victim rights statutes that we have aren't consistently followed, right? The fact that there are prosecutors' offices that still don't talk with survivors before deciding about whether they're going to charge the case or not. I mean, concept doesn't have to remain in the stratosphere. It can be very concrete about these are the behaviors that are part of, like you're saying, either recognizing that, well, he may or may not, he being, you know, as a stand-in for the suspect or the perpetrator, and we need to ask all those questions about alternatives if he's not going to acknowledge and how we think about prison and treatment. But again, for many people, the fact that they get to sit across, not get to, but the fact that they can sit across from a prosecutor who's interested and who says, you know, here's what the criminal legal system will or won't do, the fact that so many aren't getting that. I had a survivor, I remember 20 years ago, even the time it was taking for the case to move through, and she finally wrote a letter to the prosecutor and said, I am not a manila folder on your desk. I'm a real person. You need to talk to me. And I still remember that, you know, the institutional process, factory making, if you will, of thinking about justice that way of, is part of what we're struggling against, right? That it lacks some soul in some ways, not to be so dramatic, but there are very tangible things that we know could be happening to make that process better. And then, of course, there's the large question about the outcomes we're seeing. But sorry, I just wanted to throw that in.
Yeah, absolutely. And I appreciate that because I think that is important. While we want to step back from our daily work and kind of think about the big picture of justice and what it means, we do also want to think about what it means for our daily work. So what are the things that we can do? What are the ways that we can create change to improve these responses at the same time? So it's not too big of an agenda, I think, for a 90-minute call, right? So we get, you know, on our email a little report that's showing who's on the call, and I know we've got some sexual assault programs and some dual programs on the call and domestic violence programs as well. So, and I'm sure that you all have had participated in thinking around some of these issues or struggled with some of them yourself. So I remind you to press *1 to join in the conversation. You'll get to the operator, then the operator will let us know that we have somebody waiting on the line, and we'll be able to bring you into the conversation. And in particular, I'm seeing Bluegrass Rape Crisis Center and Carrie and Jennifer. I know we've had the chance to have some conversations related to some of these issues, and I know you've had conversations within your program. So if one of you is available and would be willing to press *1, if you've got a comment or a thought or a question for us to continue talking about. Carrie or Jennifer, are you there? Candy always tells me I need to be sure to give enough pause to allow people to join in.
That's right, because not everybody can find those buttons right away.
I need to do music, like hum or something while that's happening. So I will just remind you to do that. Maybe, Sandy, you could hum while we're waiting on that.
No. I'm confident Jennifer or Carrie have tons of things to say, or other people on the call, too.
Yep. And you can always email Liz as well. So, and we keep that open invitation there. Not just for Carrie and Jennifer, but for anyone on the call. And Abby, let's pull you back in as well. What are your thoughts as we go down this road and thinking about the criminal legal system and how justice is and is not part of that system for survivors?
Yeah. So as Laura was talking, I thought it was interesting to, again, you know, she was talking about the tangibles and intangibles and then getting a little bit more concrete. And in particular, in terms of the impact of trauma, how consistent it is that if law enforcement is either understanding it or are that their protocols are reflecting the realities of it, how that can be so much better for the outcomes in the system on so many levels. So for the woman, she is feeling much more heard because the questions that they might be asking would be things more like about her actual experience. You know, what was the worst part of it? What, you know, what was her experience as opposed to, you know, who, what, where, when, which does not reflect her experience and is not particularly useful information for law enforcement, even though often that's how they've been trained to ask the questions. So there are these places where we can see that there's, you know, a very fortuitous overlap between what could feel more like justice for the survivor and have better outcomes in many ways in the criminal legal system. I know I have worked with women who have had cases taken forward and have, you know, and I'm sure, as with other people, have just seen the full range of experiences from it being absolutely horrible to one woman in particular stands out to me because she repeatedly said, you know, I had the chance to tell my story on the stand and was so thrilled about that, in particular because she said that she had so many friends who or women in her life who had been assaulted and hadn't had that opportunity either because they didn't report, didn't want to report, you know, knew that our criminal legal system is usually so hostile to women reporting, or, you know, did and weren't believed or, you know, whatever the myriad reasons. And she felt as though her voice was the voice of so many women in her life. He was not successfully prosecuted, but in terms of kind of the criminal legal system outcome of being found guilty by the jury, and yet for her, that felt like, I don't know if she would call it, you know, the word justice, but clearly what felt very important for her, and she, you know, had the sense that there was this system that was behind her, which also, you know, reminds me of what Laura was saying about the just paying for evidence collection, that there is a system in place that, you know, kind of sees what's happening and is responding in ways that, you know, are getting them closer to what their ideal outcome would be.
I'm going to jump in here
okay.
in a second, Abby, because we have Bluegrass Rape Crisis.
Oh, great.
So I want to invite them into the conversation. Operator, can you open the line for Bluegrass? They are still in the queue. Liz, can you help us out with that?
I think their lines are open. Bluegrass, are you there?
Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Hi.
Hey, Liz.
Hello, how are you all?
Really well. Is this Carrie?
This is Jennifer.
Hi, Jennifer.
So I just typed in a message, I think, to Liz. One of the things, for some reason, that this conversation has made me think of is that it was probably months and months ago that this conversation took place, but it was actually at a multidisciplinary meeting, and it was the sergeant over the Crimes Against Children unit who, and everybody at the table, from advocates to social workers to the prosecutor and law enforcement were discussing, everybody I should say except the victim, so that's an important note, but we're discussing a particular case, and I don't remember the nature of the case, but I do remember at one point that the sergeant, in response to some of the frustrations about the failure of the case to move forward in the criminal justice system, said, you know, you can't, at this point, we can't expect the criminal justice system to give us justice. The best we can ask is that it will follow the letter of the law, which I thought was a really interesting distinction that he made, and I still haven't decided if that makes me more disillusioned or less so. But it was a moment of sort of shared understanding because I saw his frustration with the failures of the system. So Now, the statement that he made was also a little bit defeated, so he wasn't giving me a whole lot of hope that he was going to try to work to change it, but that did give me some place to start.
Yeah, that's really interesting, Jennifer, and if you could stay on the line for a minute. Laura, it's making me think of going back to your early comment about justice making. So even if we are talking with law enforcement or prosecutors and we're talking about justice, are we necessarily talking about the same thing?
Wow, yeah, so many thoughts. So, yes, I think that's a great question. And, of course, I won't always I won't dare to try and answer that. I think it might be a localized thing. And in some ways, there are some inherent tensions in terms of just perspective and what disciplines themselves feel their jobs or might be trying to do. And I don't know how well I'm answering that, but let me think about your question. Where what Jennifer's comment made me think of, and I'm totally filling in a story here for what that investigator or sergeant might have been saying and thinking. But we haven't talked about it that yet. And that is that in at least mainstream culture and criminal legal systems, it's largely juries that make these decisions about cases unless it's a plea agreement and then sometimes a bench trial. But I would still argue that at least in the plea agreement, the ghost of what juries might do is really affecting and driving things. And there's a lot to be sort of unpacked there. But what I call it is kind of the circling the drain phenomenon, that because juries won't go for this, that, you know, prosecutors decide I can't charge and I can't reasonably expect to win that case. And then investigators sort of know that, and then they realize, like, that case isn't going to go further. And then all of a sudden we're back to really the first exchange on a disclosure, thinking, somebody saying, well, because of my 10, 15 years of experience, I just know right now this case isn't going to go anywhere. And an investigation really hasn't even started. And so I don't know how well I'll express what's in my head, but what I'd want to say is, and maybe it's my bias because it's, you know, where I've chosen to try and work, but I'm not willing to give up on the fact that, you know, the criminal legal system should and can do better than that. I mean, there are some structural challenges for sure, but I could talk about some of the projects and the things we're looking at these days to really try and change that. Now, having said that, of course, there will be there are some consistent gaps that don't get attended to well in this larger context, and we can talk more about that soon, but particularly for marginalized communities who may feel like, look, by disclosing and having the weight of the system charge somebody from within my own community, that's going to stigmatize us further, and kind of these really impossible choices about my own sense of wanting accountability or wanting to be, wanting not to be harmed and other people not to be harmed. But by the same token, if the mainstream community is going to sort of see this happen this way and what are my alternatives, as well as kind of the all-or-nothing proposition, quite frankly, right? Like, we can see that either the system pulls out all the stops and can go after with its full weight and fury, you know, and align to do something, or it does pretty systematically, if we look at the data, you know, a small percentage are getting through to conviction. So it's not even doing kind of what in theory it's designed to do particularly well in sexual assault cases. So therein lies the challenge, right? But you know, I think thinking about alternatives for a whole host of reasons is really meaningful and juicy work. I don't mean to at all give that lip service, but I'm not willing to also say that, you know, it's a lost cause, because I think there are a couple things particularly we're on the brink of now that I think maybe I'll be proved wrong, but I think could be transformative, and that I hope we all can sort of get behind. But that's the reason I went into the circling the drain thing. So if you can figure out some of the things that reinforce those loops where it comes all the way back and people sort of throw up their hands early on, then and start to help see that they actually can shift some of that stuff fairly dramatically. One concrete example I would give is in Minnesota, until a couple years ago, we couldn't use expert testimony in sexual assault cases. Now every state in the nation can do that, but how are we, you know, how are prosecutors, how are the rest of us thinking about educating juries about really why, kind of to Abby's point, about why trauma looks the way it does and why these perceptions that that the defense attorney starts with, you know, are kind of never questioned about how a victim would react. I've almost gotten to think that in the system we sort of, and I say this pretty frankly here, but I'm very nuanced about it and careful in my work, but really it almost has seemed to me like the reference in the investigation starts off with a presumption of doing the defense attorney's work for them. And I think we can shift that to going on offense. There's all sorts of things I could name, but
that's interesting. And actually, I want to invite Carrie and Jennifer to stay in the conversation, or if you have any thoughts based on what you're hearing from Laura. But I have heard investigators say it. I mean, identify their work and say, I'm asking you what a defense attorney would ask you, or if you can't handle this for me, you can't. So and in initial interviews, evaluating how good a survivor would be on the stand, that she could ever make it to. But Jennifer.
Well, can I just say something quickly? Let me just say one more thing, Dan, quickly. So having said that, let me just be clear that I actually, so if I were sitting in this team moment that Jennifer brought up about this sergeant, I by no means want to say, like, he's just wrong. The challenge we have is to step into the spot of curiosity and say, what's happening behind the scenes that is very real, and he's just brave enough to say it, you know, or he's just honest enough to say it, that we could start to say together, well, what's reinforcing that? Why? Because his statement suggests to me that he sees there's a case there. But he's just saying we can't expect anything better out of the system to deliver on accountability or protection or whatever. That's what I hear
right,
in that.
Right.
And
yeah,
so,
yeah.
So I sure wouldn't say, you know, you're wrong or you're just not trying enough. No. This is somebody who's being really honest, and we appreciate those allies, and then we just get really curious for our system change work. Sorry.
Exactly. So Carrie or Jennifer, if one of you is still on, I'd be interested in knowing if it raised questions for you that you could envision posing or engaging in a conversation with that investigator or that law enforcement official about.
Am I live on there?
Yes, we can hear you. Yep.
Okay, great. This is Carrie. I wasn't in the meeting that Jennifer was referencing, but I do hear the similar attitude from my local area. And one of the challenges I feel for our clients is that they have very limited communication with their with the state's attorney prior to any grand jury meetings. They see clients that I've worked with, and this may be, maybe I'm going down a rabbit hole very separate to what she was saying, but there's very limited communication between the client and that attorney to feel like that they can feel prepared for court. And it seems that the attorneys must be making some of these decisions only speaking with the investigative officer, reviewing the paperwork that's landed on their desk, and I don't see a real investment in time with these clients prior to a grand jury level and definitely not an encouragement for those clients to be working with a crisis center to help them feel stable so that they were called to court.
Mm-hmm.
They actually have a grip on how they're going to handle that stressful moment.
Mm-hmm.
I see that it's limited, and I think that's where I have room for improvement in my advocacy.
Yeah. Well, and when you think about the institutional advocacy and what we talk about at the Institute, then does that help you identify places where you could see that changes could be made, or you could engage in conversations that might lead to changes?
Absolutely. I think it changes the way I, through this approach, it changes the way I might challenge some of the acts of omission. I might not wait on the client to always say, well, you know, I haven't heard from my attorney in 3 weeks, but I might be more proactive in communicating with that attorney ahead of time, saying, by the way, I'm an advocate with this client. And it also changes the information that I'm giving the assistants in that office as well.
Mm-hmm.
So if the attorney is not, for example, actively seeking out an advocate, or I don't feel that they've given the client a lot of information, then one of the things that I can do is improve the other people in their office, the front desk assistant, their victim's advocate that they may have. I'm working the wide variety of cases they have, make sure that they know who I am and what I do, so that it's not only me just relying on the attorney to make that decision, but they might be influenced by people in their own office. And it might give some credence to my advocacy efforts if someone else in my office has information. And as far as addressing the attitudes, I'm really kind of stuck. I'm not sure how to get, besides the private meeting where I've just made an appointment to stop in for 15 minutes, I'm not sure how to train or work with attorneys at this point. I haven't found a way for me as a lone advocate to do that. I think that's more of a systems approach within our advocacy movement statewide, and we need to figure out a more functional way to do that.
Well, let me ask, Carrie, I appreciate your engaging in the questions and the conversation with us. And Abby, do you have any thoughts on what you're hearing from Carrie?
Yeah, well, one of the things is just being at that table and hearing that comment. I guess I'm echoing Laura to a certain degree. I'm so curious about what he meant. And I mean, he's identifying gaps for us, it seems like. So, and, you know, he's an ally within the system. And so, yeah, I was like getting so excited just hearing that. And it's so, encouraging. I think that we are at those tables and having and hearing that honest feedback from other, you know, people who are in other systems, because to me that's just where there is so much potential for growth and, you know, working together across system lines to make changes potentially. I mean, I don't know if there's legislative change possible in that, or if, yeah, like what he was seeing that you know, that the statute is not addressing, and that is what he thinks of as justice. So that to me, it just seems like there's so much potential in that. In terms of actually working with our law enforcement and prosecutors, I think there's, you know, having those one-on-one meetings and being prepared for them and hopefully having more than 15 minutes can be so powerful in terms of creating relationships for both of you to kind of shine when you get back into your community meeting. So, you know, you're looking at ways that whether it's more support for the survivors or, you know,
where are things kind of not happening that where you can work together and have a win-win in your relationship.
I want to make sure, you know, we in this conversation that we also have some time to talk about the reality that the criminal legal system doesn't work for everyone, that it's not, you know, I think about the way that, you know, I'm a middle-class white family, and at school we had Officer Friendly come to talk to us about how the police are our friends, and, you know, and that the reality that that's not the experience for a whole lot of folks in the United States and a whole lot of survivors. That we would potentially be providing advocacy for. And, you know, I think about Native communities, I think about communities of color, and not only bad outcomes, but it's not necessarily a system that is considered a place that somebody would turn for help. It could more likely be the opposite, that this isn't a place where I would get the help I need. It is a place that might, in fact, cause me to be separated from my children or to lose my home or to end up in jail myself. So let's talk about that a little bit and what the implications are for justice when it would be the opposite experience for some people when we think about the criminal legal system. Again, a simple question, right, to throw out there. I will be kind and not start with Laura. And I know, you know, we also have Priya on the line, and Priya with Manavi, this I would think would come up in multiple ways for many of the survivors you work with. Sandy, I'm sure in your experiences, an advocate as well. So I would invite any of you to chime into this conversation, as well as our participants. Please press *1 to get in the operator queue. Thank you for Carrie and Jennifer for showing us how easy and painless it can be. Or to email Liz at praxisinternational.org. So, Priya, are you? I know we weren't sure how your cell phone would be, but let's give it a try. Are you? Some thoughts to share on that?
Mommy, is it okay?
I can keep talking. Okay. I'll let you know.
Sorry, everyone. I'm on my cell phone. I'm in a bit of connectivity issue here. When you said that sometimes interaction with the criminal justice system for immigrant survivors can be so difficult. I worked recently with a woman who is working class, limited English proficiency, has a family, and it was a slightly different situation where she had to file charges against the husband, but she didn't want to do that because the reality then would be to lose an earning member of the family also. So, and that is part of the thing when you look at somebody who's, as an immigrant, where it's so difficult to kind of just, a lot of the time, some of them are just trying to get established, to have them to a member of the family or somebody to go through this whole process, and especially if it is a member of the family, is very difficult. That was one thing that really stood out, but she did want to approach the criminal justice. She would have wanted it, but this was an ideal situation where she found that, where she said that this had much, very difficult consequences for her than actually if she went through with it.
So it raises so many questions, and again, you know, nothing that we have time to fully or even partially explore or do justice to, if you will. But Sandy, what are your thoughts? What might you want to add as we talk about this?
I have a ton of thoughts, but I feel like I'd be hogging the line. You know, when we have you know, I'm looking at who's on the call today, and I would love to hear. Now, I see Nan and Jan and John maybe on from Family Violence Project. I know you always have a ton of things to say. Or Amy from Tri-County Safe. program, Kathleen from Eastern Shawnee, like any of you that are on the call today, like what are you hearing from women about, you know, what we've been talking about today? Do any of you have anything to, you know, talk to us about or tell us about in terms of what the survivors in your community are saying about justice and how it's, you know, how they're feeling believed or that there is justice or what they're kind of looking for?
Yeah, and let me jump in, Sandy. If somebody wants to, and I hope somebody will from that, from the folks that Sandy mentioned, to join in, you could also just email Liz and let her know, and she will unmute your line. So it kind of might make it a little easier to just give Liz a heads up and say, I got a comment. Can you unmute me?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, while we're waiting for people to press star one, you know, I'll just say that, you know, it's been my experience in my community that survivors don't really feel like the use of the criminal justice system is going to benefit them. So there's so many other ways that I think people have felt that justice has been addressed. I like some of the things that both Laura and Abby talked about in terms of someone just listening to them or believing them. Sometimes that alone and in and of itself is justice. And I don't know what the answers are either, or but, you know, the purpose of this call is to just, you know, kind of really step back and take a look at our own communities and think about what people have said to us. And that's why I'm really anxious to hear from some of the other callers that are on, like Leah and Shayla, if you're here from Memphis. I know you're doing an awful lot of work in the communities. Like, what's going on there, and what are you hearing?
Sandy, Diane, can I pop in just with a couple thoughts while we're waiting?
Of course.
Unless you know someone's ready. One is that I think this is really the crux of a challenge for us about, because when I put on my individual advocacy lens, there is no way that I want the burden of creating a safer community on the back of, you know, an individual survivor, right? And that's sometimes what can happen about the misapplication of restorative justice, too, right? Like, this is what you need to do so that we hold offenders accountable and restore the community. And this revictimization and how that can play out, I think particularly in, like, the case that Priya was giving the example of. So always, needing to think about that. But then with our institutional and community lens, we're a little bit challenged, aren't we? Because I think it's a little bit problematic to think that we all don't lose out if there are whole communities of people that don't see the criminal legal system as a viable system. I mean, I know it's true, and I'm not trying to change your mind, but the point is do we just in our institutional lens stuff say, well, like that sergeant, gee, that's the way it is. There should, you know, okay. That's problematic in my mind. The answer can't be on the back of an individual survivor. Well, then let's just do, they should think differently. No, the burden is on us or on the mainstream system to say, why does that gap exist? So I just personally would say we might need to hold both, depending on where we're moving, or that's at least I would throw that out for not a definitive statement, but for a question. Can we hold both? That for many people in communities of color or other any marginalized group that doesn't feel for all sorts of reasons that the criminal legal system is an option, how do we honor that and look at alternatives and deal with that at the same time as saying to the mainstream criminal legal system, you know, there's a problem here if whole sectors of our community aren't engaged. And I don't have an answer. I'm just saying, can we hold that tension? That would be one thought. And the other, quite frankly,
Laura?
Is – sorry.
Oh.
I was going to finish by saying the other is I think one of the things that's coming up that really gets at the heart of an opportunity to think about how this is all going to work out is all the work happening around trafficking, because it gets at the core. Anyway, I'm seeing some of these core issues being discussed about what kinds of, you know, who's justice for and what does justice look like. So I would just throw that out, that that might be a place as we work on those issues to really get at some of the core questions. That's all.
Yeah, and this is Sandy, and I would agree with you, and that's what makes this so complex and difficult, because as advocates, we want to, you know, engage with the women who come into our program to find out what it is they want and need. And if, you know, like a few years back, I was working with some women in a reservation community where the cops were luring women into their police cars and taking them out in the woods and raping them. You know, so, like, why would the Native women in that community report to law enforcement?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, so you have that whole issue. And then our role as advocates is, you know, to advocate for all women everywhere. And what does that mean in terms of changing how institutions are responding? So it gets really, really complicated. And... you know, that's just one example from my experience, and I'm thinking that everybody on the call has probably got similar experiences. And then when you have a dual program, you know, like what are some of the challenges and what are you hearing from the women that are accessing your program? And then, I mean, there's just so many complicated issues to talk about, so I'm just getting more...
I remember that, I mean, when you look at dual programs and also just talking about looking at other support systems in the community, I can, between working with survivors of domestic violence and of sexual assault without patients, there are so many times where domestic violence, the survivor will reach out, families try to negotiate, where her family tries to talk to the husband's family and tries to get the husband to stop hitting her. But that's not the same way the survivor reaches out for sexual assault.
Mm-hmm.
Because the consequences of that can be very different. It's still very difficult to work with survivors of sexual assault within the South Asian community. There's a lot of victim blaming. There's a lot of shaming. So, for being able to look with this dual thing of what the consequences of even reaching out to the community and asking for support for the survivor can be very different.
Mm-hmm.
Great example. Great example, Priya.
Yeah. So it looks like we've got Bluegrass back with us. I'm not sure if it's Carrie or Jennifer. One of you online?
I'm having trouble opening their line. Joyce, could you unmute the phone line for Bluegrass?
Yes, one moment, please.
Thank you.
It's open.
Bluegrass, we have Carrie or Jennifer? Not sure. Hello?
Carrie, are you there?
It must be me. This is Carrie.
Hi, go ahead.
In thinking about this, the effects on the system with clients that I've had, one of the interesting things was creating a way for them to express how they felt about not putting all their eggs in one basket, that a conviction wasn't going to determine the rest of their life. And that is really challenging and something that I'm wanting to learn more about professionally, but helping them see other avenues of justice and or ways that they can feel empowered outside of that, because there's not a guarantee that you're going to get the conviction that you want. And in particular, I'm thinking of a client a few years ago who the conviction included at the maximum like a 3-year sentence. And at the end of that, you know, she felt great about that initially. And at the end of that 3 years, her challenge was feeling that she was completely vulnerable again, that she could be found by this person again. And so it was really challenging to see that cycle of what I saw as minimal justice for her come back to bite her, because then she had no more protection. The protection was done and ended. And so that was interesting and also challenging to see that outcome for her, and also difficult for us to continue a conversation between her and law enforcement when the perceived threat was just the possibility of that coming back on her. So I don't know. I know that adds to the conversation, but that was just my personal reflection on something I've seen with a client.
Yeah. You know, Abby, you made in our conversations leading up to this call, you were saying something about really bad outcomes for some survivors you've worked with, including, mm-hmm. Well, why don't you share that? But thank you, Carrie.
There was just a prosecution that ended a few weeks ago in our community, in which the perpetrator is extremely wealthy and hired 3 different law firms. And so there was a whole kind of team of attorneys. And to our county attorney's credit, they went ahead because the victim wanted to. And, I think many of us remember the Kobe Bryant case where the county just said, you know, we can't afford to do this. And the county attorney here just said, nope, we're going to do it. And, it was just, there were so many resources poured into it from the defense side that, you know, the county attorney really didn't have a chance. And one of the things that I was just thinking about when everyone's been talking is how so much of this is just a reflection of the larger, societal ignorance. And there, you know, in every sexual assault trial that I have been a part of, you know, the defense team is just working from this, taking advantage of the ignorance of the larger public. And, in jury selection, one of the things that we have seen is if a woman acknowledges that she is a survivor of sexual violence, then she's not on the jury. And to me, this is just completely ludicrous. Like, I also happen to believe that all women in our society are, you know, sort of by definition survivors of sexual violence by living in our society. And so, you know, any woman that acknowledges the prevalence of, you know, gender inequality and sexual objectification is, you know, not allowed to actually inform other jury members about kind of what the realities are of sexual violence. And so the whole, you know, it really was a horrible experience for the victim, they haven't done the full jury pooling yet, but when they interviewed the head jurist, the first word that he used was implausible in the victim's story. And there was some expert testimony, and we had an amazing sexual assault nurse examiner. I just keep coming back to, how this is so much about kind of the conditions that give rise to the violence, I guess, that, you know, there, as long as our, individuals in our society are so overwhelmingly ignorant about what is happening, then we are really facing an uphill battle. And to me, this has a lot to do with the silencing of victims and the voice as well. So this truth-telling piece, you know, potentially could unlock some of this. We actually recently did what started as a quote-unquote speak out and ended up in sort of this kind of large theater piece. And, you know, it was, we had a big audience for our community. About 300 people came, and it was so freeing for the individuals involved, and it was one of the things that was so interesting, I think, for the advocates working on the project was just what a relief it was for women to just be able to talk about the realities of the violence in their lives without having to couch it in research or, you know, is this going to be believed? It was just people just wrote it and said it, and no one worried about, you know, whether it was going to be believed. And I actually reached out to some of our local law enforcement because I just wanted them to know that there are going to be people getting up on the stage and talking about not being believed and the impact of that for them and the impact on the larger society. And you know, they kind of went into damage control mode and were like, oh my gosh, you know, you got to keep them from saying that. And I was like, hey, look, you know, this, they're just telling the truth. And if we, you know, want to work more towards, you know, that not happening, great. And I, as a community partner, just need to tell you that this is what's going to happen.
Well, Abby?
Yes.
And this is Sandy. You know what this makes me think about, you know, because obviously this, what we're talking about is so complex, but it just makes me think about, like, some of the things that we're talking about in the Advocacy Learning Center in terms of, you know, in different places where I go, people talk about educating the jury. Well, you know, that gets pretty broad and complex when you think about it, but when you think about jury pools and where they're pulled from, a huge part of our role as advocates is that community education or raising awareness, you know, because I think the jury pool is, they're probably not going to listen to women who have been raped or bring people onto the jury in the same way, like these women that you're talking about. But if they're selecting a jury pool, you know, if we can get, do our jobs better as advocates and, you know, educate the community in different ways about it, I think we may have better chances of pulling some good jury pools together. I mean, that's just one thing that it makes me think of amongst the 10,000 other things that are going through my mind right now, and how very challenging our work is as advocates and how much more there is we can and should be doing. Yikes.
Well, Sandy, this is Diane, and I think that's a great transition that you did not even know you were making to our next call, where we're going to explore more about that. So to really look at not only concepts around restorative justice, but also community accountability and community readiness and the role of community advocacy in justice for survivors. So what does that look like? What does it mean? What are our questions about it? And really, as we did today, asking a lot of questions and creating a space to step back from our work and together give some thoughts and wrestle with some of these challenging questions that and hear about, you know, some of the answers that are out there, but knowing that it's not an answer for everyone and in every case and in every community. So I'm excited about that call. So thank you. Thank you, everyone who has participated, to all of the Class H and Class I teams who joined us today. I want to, before we say goodbye, invite Liz in for any announcements that we have for the classes.
Thanks, Diane. Just briefly. We will not come together again for another affinity discussion for a few months now. It won't be until August 7th. that we'll have another affinity discussion, but stay tuned to your publicity, and we will keep you apprised of all the details that you need to know relative to that session. Prior to that, we'll have an opportunity to come together between classes, and actually we'll be able to welcome our latest class, Class J, for a keynote discussion July 16th, so check your calendar. That session, keynote lecture, will be for classes H, I, and J. Those dialogues and lectures are always so fascinating. So make sure it's on your calendar, July 16th, August 7th. And then also just do a quick little double check that class I should have a strategy session on the 15th of this month of May. And class H, your session will be on Tuesday, May 27th. So those are all the events. The only other thing to remind you of is that in a few moments in your email inbox, you will receive the evaluation for this session today. And so please just spare a few moments of your time to share your thoughts and give us feedback, valuable feedback for programming, how we shape what we offer to you. It's so important that you contribute your thoughts. So please do that. And thanks to all of our speakers today and all of you for joining into the conversation. Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Liz. Thank you, Laura. Thank you, Abby.
Thank you.
Bye, Sandy and Priya. Thanks, everyone.
Bye, everyone.